everyone, and welcome back to the Pro Bono Happy Hour. I'm David Lipscomb, Director of Strategic Communications for PBI. We have another great episode for you. This week, PBI's law firm pro bono project assistant, Eva Richardson, talks to Jonathan Baum of Catton, Muchin, Rosenman. Jonathan is a special guest for us as he's been a longtime friend of PBI and holds a special honor of having attended one of our first conferences, as he discusses in his interview. Jonathan also has the important distinction of having become a pro bono partner back in the days when that concept was brand new, so we were able to get a unique then and now perspective from him. He also talked to us about how his firm got a pro bono clinic started at a school in Chicago and about how the firm chooses pro bono matters, particularly controversial ones such as those involving gun control, which many firms tend to steer clear of. As always, we hope you're comfortable wherever you may be, whether that's mid-commute, on your lunch break, working at your desk, or maybe scraping those last bits of snow off of your driveway. And we hope you enjoy the interview.
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you for joining us today on the Pro Bono Happy Hour. We really appreciate you taking some time to talk with us. So let's jump right into it. I'd like to start off by asking you about a legal clinic that your firm started in a Chicago school, and you presented on this at the last PBI annual conference. So can you talk about this clinic a little bit and your experience starting it?
I was at a conference about 3-4 years ago, and I went to a session on education law. And I expressed some frustration at the session because our law firm represents a number of school districts, bond work, and so forth. So we're conflicted out of a lot of the traditional ways of supporting education, like representing students, special education students, and so forth. So I heard about another firm at this at the conference, about another firm that had started a legal aid clinic in a low-income public school in Baltimore. And it occurred to me, this was a way in which we could not only meet community needs, but we could support education. Because I'm on my local school board, and one of the things that I've learned over the years, the sort of common research, is that the more closely families of the school community are tied to the school, the better the kids do. And so there's that additional benefit. So I came back from that conference, and we already had a relationship with the Jose de Diego Community Academy, which is a Chicago public school in a heavily low-income, heavily Latino neighborhood. We had done things of a non-legal nature with them. We had done book drives and tutoring and other kinds of sort of general support. And so I thought, well, what if we could put a legal aid clinic in the school? And so I made two contacts. One was with the principal, with whom we already had a relationship. And the other key contact was with what is now known as LAF, which was the Legal Assistance Foundation of Metropolitan Chicago, which is the LSC grantee agency for the Chicago area and the largest single provider of legal aid in Illinois. And because I knew I was going to need their help, and they were wonderful. And we worked almost a year putting together the proposal to bring to the school. And the principal was very enthusiastic, and the Chicago Public School System was supportive. And so we set this thing up where we have, on the third Wednesday evening of every month during the school year, we are in the basement of the school in what used to be actually a health clinic, but it closed several years ago, taking on whoever comes in the door. We principally serve the families connected with the school, but we also serve the larger community. And we do advice and referral and, in many cases, extended representation in landlord-tenant, family law, consumer issues, expungement, public benefits. We take appointments. We have both appointments and walk-ins. And we staff the clinic. We have 4 Catton attorneys at each clinic and 2 attorneys from LAF. And LAF has done training for our attorneys and provided and helped us develop training materials and working materials for the clinic, like, you know, a Social Security questionnaire or a family law questionnaire. And so the client, our attorneys interview the clients at the clinic, and then we have an attorney's room where they go and confer with the LAF attorneys and other Canton attorneys, figure out what advice they should give to the client. They go back and give the client advice or a referral, or they take on the case. We had one case we took on that we spent 14 months on because a homeless woman had gone to a what they called an apartment finding service, which had ripped her off for $1,500 and not found her a place to live. And it was hot and heavy litigation, but we you know, did get her money back. Mm-hmm. It's been so we have a pool of about, I'd say, 35 to 40 attorneys who rotate through the clinic. We've seen over the past, the clinic is now, let's see, it's been in operation about 2.5 years, I'd say we've seen maybe 150 clients.
Oh, that's great.
I'll tell you, it is wonderful. And one of the most interesting things is it's hard to get attorneys to come to the clinic, Canton attorneys, mainly because, partly because they're busy, but partly because there's what we call the fear factor, which is this is a foreign environment for them. And one of the things about professionals, including attorneys, is they like to feel competent, you know? And we have that there's this fear among people who are very good at what they do in this office that in that environment, in that setting, that they will not be competent. And so we need to increase their comfort level. You know, we do that some of that through training. And but the best way is through experience, where they see that it's okay to say to the client, I don't know. I have to look it up. I have to consult with somebody, whatever. But the key, the proof that it works is that while it's often difficult to get people to come to the clinic for the first time, we have never had an attorney from Canton who has gone to the clinic and not come back.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's really great. Do you have any other lessons learned from the experience of starting a clinic or particular challenges that you encountered?
Well, one is, you know, work closely with your legal aid providers. Mm-hmm. That's a key one. As with everything in pro bono, buy-in from firm management is critical. At our last clinic, which was in our November clinic, the managing partner for our Chicago office came and worked in the clinic. Our firm chairman authorized one of our top paralegals to dedicate a certain number of his hours per month to serve as the administrator for the clinic. And so, you know, those kinds of things are really critical to success.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Speaking of the PBI annual conference, actually, have regularly attended since the very beginning. In fact, I think you may have one of the best attendance records of anyone. So this puts you in a unique position to kind of see how the conference has evolved over the years. So can you talk a little bit about how you've seen the conference change and grow over time?
Well, grow, of course, is the most operative word.
Yes.
I mean, I attended my first one in 1994, which it was in Arizona. I don't know if that was the first one. Maybe it was the second or third one. But,
yeah, I believe so, yeah. I believe it right around there was the first one, yes.
But, so the growth in attendance, I mean, not only the growth in sheer numbers, of course, but also in the breadth of the attendance. So the legal services providers, the in-house people, and the people from the private law firms has been a significant development. I think another thing that has been helpful is that I find that the presentations are more concrete. That is, and that makes them more useful. So I think they're you know, it used to be more at a kind of 30,000 foot level, a sort of more philosophical level. And I find that there's a lot more nuts and bolts has emerged over the years, and that's very helpful. But the most helpful thing is the honesty. My experience with these conferences is that they are utterly worthless unless people are being honest. Because there's no point, you know, is nothing more frustrating than sitting in a room with people saying, well, everything is fine at my shop, you know?
Right, right.
You know, first of all, they're probably lying. And secondly, you know, then why are you here?
Uh-huh.
You know? And I have found, as the years have gone by, and it fluctuates, but overall, there's been an upward trend in the candor that people bring to these conversations. And they say, you know, I've really got this problem at my firm. And then people say, yeah, me too, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's how you get someplace. So that's what I find to be the most valuable aspect of the conference.
Oh, great. I'm really glad to hear that. And so jumping back to your firm's pro bono program for a little bit, how do you decide which pro bono matters you'll take on, and how do you vet potentially controversial cases? I know your firm is involved in gun control cases, and a lot of firms don't do that type of work. So could you talk a little bit about how you select pro bono matters?
Well, as a general principle, we try to have do pro bono that it is the pro bono that our attorneys want to do. So we do have some signature projects, I mean, like the clinic, and that are sort of broader. But for the most part, you know, we're saying to our individual attorneys, what do you want to do? And we will help you to do that.
Right.
So most of the case selection, I guess, at least as an initial matter, comes from what it is that our attorneys want to do. Now, most of our matters do come from legal aid organizations, so they'll, you know, and so they're picking off a list, that provides an important screening. And one of the, you know, major criteria we use in what agencies we want to work with is how well do you screen your cases. And we have some agencies throughout the country. I think in New York, we work a lot with Volunteers of Legal Services, VOLS.
Yes.
In Charlotte, we work with the Council of Counselors' Rights a lot. We work with Betsedic and Public Counsel in L.A. And we work a lot with the National Immigrant Justice Center, Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. But so a lot of it is, you know, what does the attorney want to do? Is it coming from through an organization, you know, whose judgment we respect to vet in that way? And as far as this dimension of the political, I don't want to diminish that. I mean, I certainly have had cases over the years that I would have wanted us to take that we didn't do for political reasons. And I think probably everybody who is involved in a pro bono program at a major law firm in the country would say the same thing. What I have tried to do and been successful at is that I've never wanted us to have a rigid policy saying we don't do this kind of case or that kind of case. There's been pressure at times from some people within the firm to have such a policy. I just think that locks you in too much, and it ignores how the political winds shift. And I'll give you an example. There was a time, you know, 10 years ago, when there was a certain amount of political pressure from some people within the firm not to do gay rights work. Okay, it was too hot. It was too politically sensitive. Okay, that's all gone now. Okay. We don't have anybody in the firm saying don't do that kind of work now, okay? Ultimately, if there is a political call to be made, I bring it to the top of the firm, the chair of our firm. And that happens, I'd say, once every couple of years, 3 or 4 years. I mean, it doesn't come up very frequently. Another thing that I have encouraged is, you know, again, reflective of the diversity of our attorneys' views, is, you know, if a pro bono matter sort of leans right or leans left. In fact, I prefer when we take on some matters that lean right, because it explains why we also do stuff that leans left.
Right.
And that we're not, you know, we don't have a litmus test for the kind of pro bono work we do. As far as the gun control work, we have had nothing but enthusiastic support for that in our firm. And we've been, you know, highly visible. You know, we have worked with the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. We've done amicus briefs with them in defense of bans on assault weapons and large capacity ammunition magazines in 6 or 7 federal circuits.
Oh wow! Yeah.
I mean, we've been all over the place, and I've, you know, gotten nothing but support for that.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's good to hear. And then, I guess over the past year or so, what would you say has been your biggest pro bono accomplishment that you're most proud of?
I would have to say, I'm going to tell you sort of two oddly disparate things. One is, one of the things that I love about working in the clinic, which I do in the clinic at Jose de Diego, which I do myself, is there is an immediacy to the kind of results that you get that you seldom get in, you know, in large firm practice. And a woman came in, and she was living in an apartment which she was being evicted from because the building was being foreclosed on. And there's a law that says that if you are being evicted because of foreclosure through no fault of your own, there's a program where you can get money for transitional housing. It's called cash. It's known as cash for keys. You give them your keys, they give you cash to get a new place. And so she was looking for help in negotiating this process, and we were doing that for her. But she said, in the meantime, she said, they've shut my water off. Because the landlord, who had paid the water bill, had disappeared when the foreclosure came. And she said, I don't have any water. So I, you know, got on the phone with the water, local water official, and I got her water turned back on. And I was only half joking when I said to people, you know, that is the most tangible result I have achieved for a client in 30 years of practicing law.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, she got her water turned back on, right? But so that's sort of on one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum is this gun control work. We have been successful in persuading, you know, several federal courts of appeals. That notwithstanding the right that there is a right to keep and bear arms under the Second Amendment, that you know states and local governments have the authority to you know make these kind of sensible restrictions like saying no assault weapons and no large capacity ammunition magazines. And I think that we've made a significant contribution to the national dialogue on guns. And so that's sort of, I give you those two examples because they sort of illustrate the two ends of pro bono practice, both of which can be highly rewarding.
Oh, that's great. Those are great examples of both the small scale and the large scale. So now to wrap things up, what's on the pro bono horizon for you and your firm?
Let me do it. At the personal level and the firm level and the sort of professional-wide level. Personally, you know, I'm really happy with what I do. I think that I thought there was a certain amount of danger of burnout 4 or 5 years ago, maybe too much sameness or whatever. But then something comes along like this clinic at Jose de Diego Community Academy, and it's just totally re-energizing. So I am, you know, really enthusiastic about the work that I do, and I just hope to keep on doing it. In terms of our firm, I think that one of the biggest challenges, and you see this, I mean, I don't know if I've ever been at a PBI conference where there wasn't a session on how do you get partners to do more pro bono work, and you know, it's a universal problem. And one of the things that I'm pleased at is that our firm has just adopted a new strategic plan, and one element of the strategic plan is to incentivize partners to do more pro bono work. So I think that's a great challenge and a great opportunity, because if you get more partners to do pro bono work, you not only capture those partners' hours, but because they are role models for the associates, you'll get more pro bono activity among the associates as well. So that's a challenge that we have taken on and that I'm, you know, really looking forward to us making some progress on.
Oh, awesome. That's great.
Hmm?
I said, awesome. That's great.
As far as the profession is concerned, I think there are three things we're going to see in the next in the coming years. One is, I think, and again, I think each of these has been the subject of a PBI conference session. One is more holistic services. I think there's so much greater recognition that the person who comes in with a quote-unquote legal problem probably has a lot of other associated issues as well. And trying to work with the medical profession, with social work and so forth, to approach that more holistically, I think, is one of the things you will see as a trend in pro bono in the coming years. A second thing is, this goes back to the partner thing. The legal profession is very much, I think, was very much shaken by the economic recession and has changed in certain ways as a result. When I was coming up, you know, as an associate, you know, nobody ever imagined, worried about that they would be laid off for economic reasons. You might be fired for incompetence, but you were never going to be laid off. It just wasn't that kind of economic uncertainty. We went through the depths of the recession. A lot of people were laid off. Now we're out of that, and we're back up. But the uncertainty lingers, and it particularly lingers in the psychology of associates. I find associates are a lot, I mean, it's not that they're not committed to pro bono and they don't want to do pro bono, but they're more anxious about how do they survive and thrive in the firm. And then I say this across the board, not just our firm. And so I used to have a primarily associate-driven pro bono model, where what asking the associates, what do you want to do in terms of pro bono, finding that out, getting that lined up, and then finding a partner to supervise them. What I increasingly do, and I think this is a firm-wide, a profession-wide trend, is to go to partners and say, you know, will you take on this pro bono matter, and then recruit the associates you work with to work with you on it. Because even if the vast majority of the actual hours are done by associates, what this does is it communicates to the associates, this is a good thing to do. This is something we want and, in fact, expect you to do, and that the people you report to want you to be doing. And I think that comfort level that brings to the associates is really important. And I think that's something you're going to see more of profession-wide. And then the third thing, it actually goes back to the De Diego Clinic, which is I think there's going to be more and more individual representation. And there's a lot of reasons for this. I mean, number one, there's just incredible need for it. The second thing is, it's not. And there are always going to be impact litigation and class actions and so forth, but it's harder to win those fights in the courts than it used to be. It's harder to, even if you win them on paper, to see how they change results on the ground. And I think that, and the third thing is, I think that there will be more individual representation because that gives more meaning to the pro bono experience for the individual firm lawyer. And I see that across the board. I mean, I was at a recent APCO Academy session, and they were giving the results of a survey of 650 lawyers at four major firms about why they did pro bono and why they didn't do pro bono. And the number one reason why people said they did pro bono was, you know, not training or experience or whatever. It was, it makes me feel good about being a lawyer. And I think that rings so true. And I, that's why I say, I mean, I think helping a single individual human being it often provides that reward to the attorney in a way that working on theoretically more sophisticated but more abstract legal work doesn't. So I think we're going to see actually more and more of that.
Absolutely. Those are all wonderful insights about the profession and where we're going with pro bono. Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate you speaking with us about your pro bono program and your experiences.
My pleasure.
Thanks again to Jonathan Baum of Catton, Mutch & Rosamond for speaking with us, and we wish him continued success with his firm's pro bono program. We want to remind you that the 2016 PBI Annual Conference will be held in Washington, D.C. on March 23rd through 25th. As you heard, Jonathan is a big fan of the conference, and we hope you will be too. Regular registration rates expire on February 10th, so be sure to register before the deadline. Visit www.probonoinst.org/conference to get more information and register. To listen to more podcasts in this series or learn about additional pro bono resources, visit www.probonoinst.org/podcast. If you're interested in having your firm featured on the Pro Bono Happy Hour, please email us at probono@probonoinst.org. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you again next time on the Pro Bono Happy Hour.